The playroom at Ubuntu Academy on Troost is a sea of color and activity. There's a book station, one with blocks, tables for coloring, even a stage, maybe for an impromptu performance. Last November, the owner of the facility hosted a rally to raise the minimum wage for workers at schools like hers to $15 an hour, even though she admits that she herself would have a hard time paying her workers that much. Kimmy DeVries, a local child care worker, was at the rally. At the amount she makes, she told us that it's really hard to take care of herself.
You know, on an airplane, they tell you you have to put on your own mask first before you help the person next to you. Well, I don't have my own air mask on, so how am I supposed to help teach the kids at the most effective level if I don't have all the tools to be successful that I need?
According to the Economic Policy Institute, home health care and child care workers are among the lowest paid professionals in the U.S. Yet some might argue that the work they do taking care of the people we love makes their jobs some of the most important ones around. But while caregivers are struggling to make ends meet, the families needing care, child care, in-home nursing, or various kinds of help with an aging parent, often can't afford the financial burden, because even with as little as caregivers are paid, those services are still really expensive. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're going to explore the many layers of the relationship between work and care, cost and need, from the economics at play to the delicate interpersonal dynamics of caring for others for a living. Let's start with the economics by getting back to the child care worker we met just a minute ago. She teaches full time at a local Head Start program.
My name is Kimmy DeVries, and I'm 30 years old. I teach at a YMCA Head Start preschool as an assistant teacher. I started in August of 2012. I started out as a substitute. I was working on my master's in early childhood education at UMKC. After a while, school got pretty overwhelming trying to do full-time master's and working between 20 and 30 hours a week, so I decided to drop out of school. And so I started working full-time a little over a year ago. I work for 8 hours every day, 8 to 5. I walk in and I feel like a rock star, because when the kids see me, they're like, ah, and they like jump out their parents' arms and run over to you and want hugs. And they're just like, hi. And just, you know, my children make me feel really important. And I think they're really important too. I love my job, but I do make $10.32 an hour, and that's pretty hard to live on. So it's Monday, and I have $46 in my bank account, and I have to make it until Friday when I get paid, and I have stuff like medication that I need to get, and if I get my medication, I'm going to have $6 left. I have $90,000 in student loans, and it's pretty overwhelming amount of debt that I took on getting my undergrad and master's. I can't pay it all. It's supposed to be like $1,000 a month. Just not paying, which isn't a great plan. It's not good. And it gives me a ton of anxiety that, you know, sometimes it just you feel it in your gut. You feel this anxiety that just overwhelms you. And I just sit there because I feel paralyzed with the amount of debt that I have that I'm not paying. Being able to pay your bills and being able to live well are two different things. It's still hard. Parents at my work are going through a lot of the similar struggles that I go through as a low-wage worker. And I don't have any kids myself, but I can imagine that if I had kids, like, it would be stressful worrying if they're getting good care while I'm at work. If we say that we think children are as precious and so important for the future of our country, if they're as valuable as we say, then why are we not valuing the people who teach and care for them every day?
That was Kimmy DeVries, who works at a local Head Start program. Joining us now is Elise Gould. She's a senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute. Hi, Elise.
Hi, good morning.
We're also joined by Claire Stacey, who teaches sociology at Kent State University. Welcome to the show, Claire.
Hi, good to be here.
Claire, what do you hear in Kimmy's story? What larger trends is she tapping into?
Well, I think Kimmy's story really draws out the fact that we are fundamentally conflicted in our country about how we value caregiving, whether that's the care of children or the care of the elderly or disabled. That on the one hand, we revere this work, we pay lip service, we tell people, this is God's work, I don't know how you do it, I don't know how you care for children. And yet we don't really put our money where our mouth is in terms of policies and wages when it comes to these workers.
Elise, you conducted a study of wages for child care workers across the United States. Is Kimmy's story consistent with your findings?
Yes, absolutely. The experience that Kimmy describes is sad, and absolutely, I think that we're undervaluing our child care workers today. They are rock stars, as she says, and the kids are treating them correctly, and it is an absolute necessity in today's world that we have adequate, affordable child care for people. But unfortunately, child care workers are simply not paid for the important work that they do. So she mentioned $10.32 an hour. That is exactly the median across
in the United
the U.S.
States.
Yes, the median in the United States for child care workers in my study was $10.31. So she's pretty much right on. That's talking about $21,000 a year to live on, which is really not enough to get by across the country.
And if that's the median, I mean, how low do some of these wages get?
They absolutely go run the gamut of being even lower than that. Obviously, some areas are going to be paid higher, but in some other lower cost areas, it's going to be less expensive. And one of the things that we do in our research is we look at what it actually costs to get by. So we look at how much a one-person family budget is. And for instance, in the Kansas City area, a one-person family budget is $27,000. And that is just what it takes to get by in terms of your rent, your food, your health care, and your transportation to work. All of the basic necessities are really important to get by. It doesn't. And one of the really important things that Kimmy brought up was the fact that she has student loans. You know, any sort of debt is not accounted for in this budget. So in Kansas City, it's $27,000 to get by. And clearly on that wage that Kimmy's talking about, $21,000 is not nearly enough to even just meet your basic needs.
Your article, child care workers aren't paid enough to make ends meet. That's your article. It has an interactive map feature where you can go in and see county by county and zip code by zip code what percentage of a modest but adequate standard of living child care workers are earning in their own communities. I looked up four local counties, Wyandotte County, Jackson County, Johnson County, and Clay County, to get a feel for that percentage in our area. And it looks like preschool teachers are earning about 88% of that budget, where all of a person's basic needs are met, and other child care workers are earning closer to 69% of that amount. I mean, either way, it's definitely less than 100%. What accounts for that? Why?
Well, the difference between child care workers and preschool workers, I think, is not that important. I mean, obviously, preschool workers that are considered preschool workers may have higher credentials, and so their pay is going to be a little bit more. But even them, it's very clear that the share of the family budget that's met by earnings is not 100%, right? It's much lower than 100%, so they simply can't make ends meet. And so then the question is, well, why are they being paid so little? And I think that, you know, that's a whole nother story about whether or not we're valuing the care that they provide, whether or not there's enough money in the child care system. Because obviously there are many families that are struggling to pay for child care at the same side, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was going to say. I mean, even as much as someone might value it, if the money simply isn't there to pay what it costs, or, I mean, maybe ideally to pay more than what it currently costs, you're between a rock and a hard place.
That's right. And I think that's why it's important to really think about solutions at the scale of this problem. Families are finding childcare expenses out of reach, right? For many areas, college, in-state public college tuition is actually less than what it costs to put an infant in full-time daycare for a year. So when we think about what kind of savings that go into people parents being able to pay for college and think about, oh, now you have an infant. How are you possibly going to make that same kind of investment in a kid? It's kind of impossible. And then you think about the worker side. You want to have a high quality child care center, a high quality experience for your kid, which means you don't want to walk into a center and have there be one teacher for 25 kids. That's not high quality. It's not the kind of industry that lends itself to returns to scale that you might see in other places where technological change has maybe made workers more productive and more efficient. You actually want to have a bunch of teachers there and a bunch of resources and books and toys and everything for the kids to be able to have the most nurturing and educational experience.
Yeah, you might not be measuring that by efficiency.
Right, right. That's right. As an economist, it's not really the right principle. But when you think about the importance of that care and the importance of that care, not only for kids' future, but for parents and their ability to work, and you think about how much it's pushing parents' budgets to pay for it, how much we need to pay those workers enough, it is absolutely the kind of thing that we should think about government intervention. We should think about other solutions at the scale of this problem that would help families and help the workers and help the care that's provided to kids.
You write that people should generally be paying, could probably afford to generally be paying about 10% of their incomes for childcare, and that sweet spot would kind of denote affordability. At that rate, most childcare workers don't earn enough to pay for care for their own kids. How does that play out?
It's interesting sort of conundrum that childcare workers put themselves in. I was comparing before to one-person family budget, but let's say that childcare worker does have a kid. They simply can't afford to pay for that kid to get childcare. So there's this problem of a childcare worker can't afford childcare. Well, that seems problematic. That is just sort of not the kind of society that we might want to be constructing.
And as we've noted, it's not just them. I mean, childcare and other kinds of care are really expensive, but if it's not because the workers are being paid well, I mean, you've mentioned this ratio of caregivers to care receivers issue. You've mentioned that efficiency isn't what we value, so we're not going to do things to like increase the productivity of the care worker. Are there other reasons?
No, I think those are the two big ones, right? We want to make sure that we're getting high quality care, and you have to pay for that, right? So as an economist, there's two sides to this equation, really. There's a P, the price, and there's a Q, the quantity. So if it's not the price that's driving up costs, then it's the quantity. And the quantity is what it should be. In high quality childcare centers, you want to have quantity. Therefore, you want to have enough teachers there throughout the day. So a day for a childcare center might run, let's say, from 7 a.m. To 6 p.m. And so that means that you have many people that have to cover those different shifts throughout the day. And so you need that sufficient staffing to make that a good quality center.
Claire, you study care more generally, not just child care workers, but all kinds of professional caregivers. From an economic, sociological, and psychological perspective, what's significant about the findings that Elise has laid out to you?
Well, I think it's important in so many ways because it points to the connections across caring occupations. And so what Elise has found is pretty common. My expertise is actually in home care. And even though that is a growing occupation, it's one of the fastest growing occupations in the United States, these workers make, home care workers that is, make on average, $11 an hour. In some states, they're still making $7 an hour. It goes as high as 15.
When you say home care workers, can you describe what kind of work exactly you're talking about?
Sure. So home and personal care aides are generally low-skilled healthcare workers who take care of the elderly and disabled in their own homes. And what they do is a lot of body work. So they may clean a person who can't clean themselves, shower them, bathe them, change diapers. They also do light cooking and cleaning in the home. And then they also do what sociologists call emotion work, which is sitting with people and being companions to them and listening to them talk about their lives and their fears. One aide that I interviewed talked about how every day she would watch Days of Our Lives with her client and talk about the plot twists. And then an hour later, they would be talking about her fears of dying. And so it's this combination of, you know, hard labor, physical labor, but also emotion work that they're doing. And they're doing it for very low wages, much like the childcare workers that Elise is talking about.
Yeah. Is the financial piece of it pretty similar to what you see with childcare workers?
Yes. I mean, they are mostly, they being the home care aides, are mostly low-income women of color. A lot of immigrant women, so African-American women, Latinas, depending on where you live, women from the Caribbean or South and Central America, who are doing this work for very low wages. They themselves have families that they have to feed. They have their own caregiving, informal caregiving needs that they're struggling to deal with. And so the parallels between home care and child care are really there. And, you know, for those of us who study care work, we're really interested in how can we forge connections between these workers who work in what seems like disparate settings but suffer from some of the same low wages and sometimes very high demanding work.
Is there that same really kind of surprising interplay between people not making enough money for doing the work and on the other hand, people really struggling to be able to afford to pay for it?
Yes, absolutely. And so home care is not cheap. There are ways that families can afford it. If you are Medicaid eligible, if your loved one wants to stay in their home, many states have Medicaid waiver programs, which allow the client or the elderly or disabled person to hire their own caregiver, and the costs are offset through these Medicaid waiver programs. And then if you have resources, you can hire through private agencies. But like many things in America, there's a big middle of people who cannot really afford to pay for the care. And so for them, it's much like the childcare situation where you have families. I myself have two kids. We struggle to pay for the childcare. And it's hard knowing that the people who are caring for my children are not being paid the wages they deserve. So, yes, that rub exists for home care as well.
The kind of price dynamic that we're talking about in terms of being able to afford something, it makes it sound like something that you would think maybe is a luxury type thing. But people need these kinds of care for their loved ones, can't provide it themselves for all kinds of reasons. Can you explain some of those reasons?
Yes, of course. You know, 60% of women now work outside of the home. The number is even higher, some say. And so you can imagine we're no longer in a period where the work that used to be done by women, the care of the children, the care of elderly, that's harder for people to do. People can't live on one income anymore. And so you have dual earner families, which means that when mom or dad gets sick, or a child is disabled, they have really hard choices to make. So do you leave your job to provide care in your home? And if you do that, how can you really afford to live? And so people are really in a pickle when it comes to this. And, you know, interestingly, a lot of the people who need home care are themselves poor and their families are poor. And so while they may be able to rely on some state resources, across the board, we just see people really struggling to provide the care that their families need. And it's not out of lack of love. And I think that sometimes we judge people who don't care for their own. But, you know, we know that it's hard for American families to live on one income. And so they have to make really tough decisions about caregiving.
Is our society just, I mean, on some fundamental level, not really set up in a way that allows people to perform these tasks? I mean, it requires some combination, as you've said, of time and money, those resources, and in some cases also physical strength and really specialized knowledge. How do other cultures outside the U.S. manage this? Is it different, or is this a struggle wherever you go?
Well, I think because of the demographic bulge of baby boomers in not just the United States, but in, you know, Western countries as well, this is a problem that many modern democracies face, but we aren't necessarily doing the best job we can with this problem. So, you know, for example, in the UK in 2014, they passed the CARE Act, which basically empowers local governments and puts resources behind that to ensure that elderly and disabled individuals who want to stay in their homes can, but more importantly, that act gives resources and money to the caregivers, whether they are paid or family caregivers, so that they can do the work, so that they can get respite if they need it. There's even one provision in the United Kingdom that if you are somebody who is providing long-term care to your relative, you can get a gym membership so that you can keep your mental health and your physical health up, which we know suffers for people who are providing caregiving, that they can go and take that 45 minutes a day and go to the gym. It sounds trivial, but I think there are other countries where they've really thought through what does it mean to be a citizen, and part of that citizenship and that social right is being cared for. I don't think we've had that conversation in this country. And I think we could learn a lot from some of our European counterparts.
What kinds of personal care do we do ourselves, and what kinds of care do we outsource? Is that piece of it particular to the U.S., or is it, again, a fairly universal kind of, it's built into the biology of human beings and the lifespan and life cycle?
Well, with respect to elder care, I think it's pretty uniform. I don't know a whole lot about developing countries, but I can say that, you know, across sort of Europe and the U.S., we tend to outsource a lot of the personal care tasks, or what we call activities of daily living. And so can somebody get out of bed themselves? Can they go to the bathroom themselves? Can they dress and wash themselves? Can they cook and clean for themselves? Those are the kinds of tasks that we see families paying for others to do. Or in some countries, including the U.S., we do have programs where the state or the government will pay family caregivers. They will receive a wage as family to provide that care.
Claire, you know, in terms of this dilemma, what about how we value the work itself? I mean, we've talked about the pressures that are on the people who need the help in their homes, but is there a problem in the value we place on what these workers are doing?
Absolutely. And again, it's this fundamental contradiction that we have, where we are quick to revere those who do it and praise those who do it, at least superficially. But we don't really put the resources behind it. And I think Elise made an excellent point earlier that we have to scale this up to the scale of the problem. So this is not just about individuals. This is about, on a national level, politicians need to be talking about the value of care. And we, at the local level, our communities, we need to be talking about the value of care. And I really think that a lot of the lack of value comes from the fact that historically this is women's labor that has been done in the home without pay. And as women have gone into the workplace and we've contracted out that care to other women, we haven't really resolved how we value that. And I mean that in terms of symbolically how we value it, but also how are we going to remunerate it? How are we going to pay for it? How are we going to give people the wages they deserve to do that work?
Well, I have a call here that I want to take from Dee in Northeast Kansas City, who has a question about something that was said earlier. Dee, what do you want to know?
Well, your guest, and I know that they have a lot of knowledge in this area, but she also made the contradiction because she said that I've done this job for the same home health aide and hospice aide for 23 years, and she said that we are a low-skilled job. And I take exception to that because it takes a lot of mental and physical skills to deal with these people who are ill, deal with families who are losing a spouse, you know, for the first time. And we're, you know, every day is different. No day ends like you thought it would at the beginning of your day. The weather, the people, you know, everything. And to by a professional that's knowledge in this field to make the statement that we are low skilled, I think is inappropriate.
Well, let's hear Claire's response to that. Claire, do you want to talk about that terminology, low skilled, and what you meant
by it? Yes. Yeah, and I'm so glad the caller called, and I by no means meant disrespect. And in fact, if you look at my work, what I try to do through interviews with many, many home care aides and observations of their work is give light and voice to the hard work that it is and the skills that are involved. And so I think when I said low wage, it's classified as low skilled and low waged work by, you know, sort of if you look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, how they classify these things. But, you know, I think I fell into the same trap of using those words casually. And you are absolutely right. I'm sorry, I can't remember the caller's name.
D.
I think D is absolutely right that part of the problem is that the work that D and her colleagues are doing is skilled work. And as I mentioned earlier, we do, you know, there's emotional work involved in relating to human beings. And I don't think we value the skill that's involved in emotion work and connecting to other people. And so absolutely, I couldn't agree more with Dee that this is skilled labor. It is not recognized as skilled labor.
Elise, when it comes to childcare specifically, do you see solutions?
Yes, I think that, you know, some issues were brought up that are really useful when we think about what has happened in other countries, what kinds of efforts people have made. And also Claire talked about how we've had sort of a changing economy in this country over the last 40, 50 years. More women have entered the labor force. So the demand, not only for childcare, but also for home care that she's talking about as both parents or both adult children of parents are in the labor force. And those trends are happening for a number of reasons. One is the fact that hourly wages have been stagnant for the vast majority of workers. So I'm not talking about childcare workers here or home health workers, just workers generally. And that has meant that the only way for families to do better and to sort of make ends meet themselves is to have both parents working more hours in the labor force. So that is one trend that sort of happened. And obviously women have taken more prominent positions in the labor force over the last 50 years. So that is a changing culture. Right, changing economy, and that increases the demand for both of these types of jobs. So childcare workers in particular are really important. Having affordable childcare is really important for families. So when we think about policies that we have or don't have in this country versus other countries, or what we might have in the economy today that we didn't have 50 years ago, policies like childcare subsidies or thinking about universal pre-K, maybe expanded to younger ages to make sure that people have a better system of not only education for their kids, but childcare so the parents can go to work. And also that would help support something like parental leave, which could be family leave as well. People often talk about paid parental leave as just being about the parents so that they can take leave to be with their new child, adopted or otherwise in the family. It's also meant for people to be able to take care of their elderly parents or a sick spouse. And all of those things in the system would help culturally support families in making ends meet and be able to meet the demands that they have in today's economy.
Economist Elise Gould with us from the Economic Policy Institute. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
KCUR's Central Standard will be right back. Call 816-235-2888 with your story about professional care for your loved ones, your children, your parents, your grandparents. Were you comfortable hiring professionals to provide that care? What was hard about it, the financial piece or something else? 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with sociologist Claire Stacey. We're talking about the delicate dance professional caregivers do every day between an economic transaction they need to earn a living and the highly personal role they fill in other human beings' lives. We focused so far mostly on economics and childcare, but now let's hear the story of a home health care worker. Her schedule is really intense. She spends her nights as a full-time certified nursing assistant and part-time nursing student, and her days as a full-time single mom.
I'm Liza Wimani. I've been a CNA for 5 years. I've been in the nursing field doing home health care for about 5 years. And I have a 2-year-old daughter named Rayera. I go, usually I do the overnight shift. Sometimes I go in from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. and that's like 3 to 4 days a week. And I go to school for nursing assistant, medical assistant. I goes in the evening, and then after I leave from usually from school, I go straight to work and then come home and be with my daughter. I don't really have a support system. Like, I don't have nobody to watch her besides my grandma and grandpa, but they took care of me when I was a kid. So it's like, I don't want to, you know, repay them in that way. You know, it's hard work. It's a struggle, actually. And I, on the average, I work about 40 hours a week and making about $10 to $12 an hour, depending on where I go. And I still, it's like I still be struggling. I still be behind, even working so hard and having like a busy schedule every day. Still, I'm behind. The job that I do is really kind of a delicate type of job. It's like you're taking care of people's families, and it's like they want to make sure that their family is in good hand, and you have to be really gentle. Like, you can't, you know, be, it's kind of stressful, but you still have to maintain, you know, yourself, and it's kind of hard to maintain that every single day. So you have to know how to come with techniques for them, you know. So it's really mental, it's physical, it's all. So I really love it when the patients make me stuff. Like, they always make me something, and usually they don't make too many people stuff. And for the mean ones, they really be the ones to be making me stuff. I'm like, okay, you know, I really touched your heart. You know, that's what makes me feel. Sometimes I just go out there and cry. I don't even show my emotions, but that's the most rewarding, to be able to see that I actually touched someone's heart. I like doing it. So really, that's how, like, if it was about the money, I wouldn't be doing it, because you don't really get paid enough to do the job that I do. Like, it's not enough money at all. It's not me I'm just feeding anymore. It's another mouth I have to feed, and by making sure she have clothes on her back and a roof over her head. I does pretty good on budgeting, but I budget at just enough. So about $1,000 for my rent and bills, and then like $300 for school, and then I have to pay like for diapers and food and gas. I said about another $300, and that's exactly just probably how much I make. Like, I only make about, you know, $2,000 or so a month. I'm young, I'm only 25, and I feel like a 40-year-old. So it's like, you know, it's like, if I can just work just 40 hours a week and get by, but just me working 40 hours, I still not making enough. It's like, I'm still behind regardless, and I'm got overtime. So that's, it's like, what I'm doing this for.
TUVWXYZ. Now I know my ABCs. Next time, won't you sing with me?
Yeah. You okay? Mm-hmm. Okay. She be all right.
That was Lijua Manning. She and Kimmy DeVries, who we heard from early in the show, are both part of a movement in Kansas City for child care workers and home health care workers to make $15 an hour. Claire, Lijua talks about her job being delicate because of the lives of people's relatives are in her hands. Can you talk to me about that aspect of this kind of work?
Yes, I think Lijua, I mean, no one could say it better. She really got at the heart of what I found when I talked to about 50 home care aides about their work experiences, that, you know, a lot of the work is physical and the things you might predict. But I think the thing that people don't think about is the connections that they're making with their clients and the work that they're doing on an emotional level. And she talked a little bit about how she is tired and she's, you know, it's hard on her, but she has to maintain herself. And I think, again, that comes back to what sociologists call emotion work, which we don't often think of as labor, but it is. It's putting your emotions out there. It's putting a state of being out there for the benefit of another person when you yourself may be tired, frustrated, fatigued, And that comes at a cost for workers. But it's also kind of the beauty of what they're doing and how they themselves, in my interviews, how they find dignity in their work, because they're doing something that many of us don't have time to do for our families or cannot do for our families. And I think they get a lot of what I call the caring self. They get a lot of identity and positive affirmation from making those connections to clients. As Lijua talked about, her client making her make stuff for her and touched her heart. I do think that that is what sustains these workers in these jobs, given the fact that they are otherwise so low paying.
Can I jump in and ask you why people typically go into this kind of work? I mean, is it personal reward, like what you're describing, kind of a sense of it being a calling? Or do people tend to fall into it after maybe like having babysat for younger relatives, right, cared for a grandparent, knowing it's a skill they possess?
Well, with the workers that I've talked to, and if you look at the broader aggregate data on this population, it tends to be women who have had either other jobs in the service economy that are low paying as well. So think fast food jobs, but are looking for something else, are looking for meaningful work. And many of them, because they're majority women, have had responsibilities caring for children or their neighbors or people in their church. And they've discovered that they have this proclivity for caring, that people tell them that they're a good carer. And so they're naturally attracted to that type of work. And many of them narrate it as a calling, as God's work, as something they were born to do. But I think it's important, while those are valuable things, to remember that many of these women are working within a very constrained set of choices. And so they're choosing to go into a line of work, low-paid work, that gives them fulfillment that they may not find at, say, McDonald's.
What about looking at it from the other point of view, the point of view of someone in the potentially uncomfortable position of inviting a stranger into their home or life to care for someone who's really vulnerable at a time of real transition, like one life is beginning or maybe another is coming to an end? How do these people on opposite sides of this relationship tend to relate to one another?
That's a great question. And in my research, I shadowed home care aides and got to know some of the folks that they were caring for. And I think it's a very interesting relationship. I mean, on the one hand, what I saw were very intimate bonds of almost fictive kinship, where they were treated like family and given kind of access to people's lives and stories that made the work valuable. And I think it also makes the experience of being cared for valuable. So those intimate ties are really key. And I think many of the aides I talked to and the folks that they cared for valued the relationships that they formed with one another. The downside of that is that when you're working for pay, but then you form these intimate bonds with people, it becomes very tricky, especially in the setting of the home. So many, many aides talked about how much they cared for the people that they worked for, but they were frustrated that they'd get a call at 2 at night saying, "I'm lonely. Can you talk to me on the phone? Or can you come an hour early and pick some groceries up for me? Or I'm out of money. Can you run by the drugstore and pick up this prescription for me?" And that's where the rub really was for these aides, because they formed these ties with their clients and then feel a certain obligation to follow through with that.
I want to turn now to a nurse with Kansas City Hospice who's joined us in the studio, Lucy Stassi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Under what circumstances do you usually come into your patients' lives?
There's different aspects that we would be going into people's homes. A lot of them have been given a diagnosis that they only have a certain amount of time to be here with their family. And so we come in for information, to start providing care, education, support.
What kinds of things do you do for people that for whatever reason they can't do for themselves or their relatives?
A lot of the times we come in for medication management, pain management, symptom management that they're not able to do, but their goal is to stay at home or with a family member, do not want to go back to the hospital. So we're there caring for them very intimately.
Talk to me about the emotional aspects of delivering that kind of care.
It can be very emotional. It's very difficult going into someone's home to provide care that knowing that, you know, we're there to provide care for someone who is going to be going into the dying process. But it's hard not to become emotionally involved. So it can be very stressful at times, providing that to the patient, but also to their families.
Do you think, as a society, that there is almost like a literacy problem in terms of how to deal with these things in our own personal relationships? Is there a gap that your profession fills that is maybe something larger that's missing on some level? Not entirely. Medication management, I have no idea how to do that,
There's all different aspects. A lot of it, most of the time when we first go into a patient's home, it's getting them to trust me, to know that I'm going to be there for them and other staff that we have available to care for them both body, mind, and spirit. It is very emotional for both them and for us to be going in and doing that.
When KCUR's Central Standard, we'll be getting to your calls about the cost of care, both financial and psychological. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. Welcome back to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Gina Kaufman, joined by sociologist Claire Stacey from Kent State University and Lucy Stassi, a nurse with Kansas City Hospice. She works with patients in their homes. We're discussing the cost of care, financial and psychological cost, whether we're talking about childcare or care for an aging parent or anyone in between. Let's hear from Anna in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Anna.
Hi. I am caring for my grandma in my home, and I work full-time. So normally during the day, she has a caregiver that comes in and takes care of her. And her caregiver, I am lucky to have known since we went to college together, And she's been wonderful. My grandma really likes her and they get along really well. But on Christmas, her caregiver fell and broke her arm and isn't able to come in. So I tried to find caregivers, as a substitute. And I just had a really hard time finding anyone that I could trust. And I have some part-time like sitters for weekends and evenings that have helped out. But it's just been really hard. And I realized during this process how lucky I was when I first brought my grandma into my house last year that I knew Andrea, her regular caregiver, who didn't have caregiving experience. And she was just like me. This was going to be new to both of us, but she was out of a job and she needed work. And I said, could you take care of my grandma? And she said, I think so. I've done babysitting and nanny work, and why not?
So the personal relationship meant more to you in some ways than a professional skill?
Yes, it did, because I knew that I could trust Andrea. And Andrea is Polish. She's from a Polish family. And my grandma is also Polish. So when I introduced them, I said, Grandma, Andrea is Polish too. And they just kind of, hit it right off.
So that bond becomes important. And, as a care worker in some capacity yourself, Lucy, I wonder, when you hear that, do you think that the trust, is that hard to earn as a stranger, especially in a situation where people are so, so vulnerable at the end of life?
Trust is a very big issue. Just because here we are going into someone's home, family may not be there. So we have to earn that trust. We have to build that relationship with them, which could take quite a while, or it may just be something after a couple of visits.
We have a tweet from Courtney who sent a couple of tweets. She says, it's so frustrating knowing it costs so, when it comes to spending my income on something, I can't think of anything more important to spend it on than childcare, but it's so frustrating knowing it costs so much, yet the workers don't make enough. I just want to stop working and raise my son. Claire, we're hearing a lot of people who actually really want to be able to provide this kind of care themselves.
Yes, that's right. And I think that many families want to do that work, and often make that choice to leave their jobs to provide informal care to their loved ones. And in some states, depending on where you live, there are supports to help you do that. So there's been a movement towards consumer-directed care in home care, which means that this is usually through Medicaid. If you qualify for Medicaid, that an elderly person can decide who they want to care for them. And in many states, that means they can hire their family members. And I think these are really beneficial programs because it means that families don't necessarily have to make that choice between working and caring for their loved one.
Let's hear from Leanne in Lawrence. Hi, Leanne.
Hello.
What can you share?
Well, I have an adult daughter who is married. Both parents work, and they have two very small children. The idea of being paid to take care of your children or compensated in some way really isn't an option for them because they're both in professions where if they should step out of the workplace, they would lose the ability to come back in later on. And so they're paying so much, like your earlier guest said. They're paying probably more than tuition would be for college, yet they know that the child care workers at the really good daycare center aren't making enough really to live well. And it seems like there's something systemic wrong with this whole thing. And I was just wondering if your guests could shed some light on what might be done. I know it's a big picture problem, but something isn't working for, for so many people.
Claire, jump in here.
Sure. So I think what has worked for home care workers and some child care workers is unionization. And, you know, I know that not everyone is a fan of that solution, but the reality is that in those areas where child care workers and home care workers are unionized, they make higher wages. And, you know, the sky did not fall. The child care agencies did not close, but the workers got better wages and in some cases, benefits and sick pay. So,
did the cost go up for people who needed childcare and home health care workers in those areas?
My understanding is minimally, so that it hasn't translated into huge costs on the part of those who are paying for care. And so, you know, I think that when you hear about childcare workers or home care workers who are trying to organize, ask about that. Ask how you can support that. Because we know that that has worked in terms of raising wages, and some would argue that it's worked in terms of producing quality, better quality care. Because when you have happier workers, you're going to have happier children or happier elderly people.
Let's hear quickly, very quickly, from Gio in Lee's Summit. Hi, Gio.
Hey, how you doing? Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I used to be a healthcare worker years ago. Matter of fact, I did it in the homes. And I became the type of person that when I would get off of work, I would, like, call them and check on them, and they would call me. Most of my patients had Alzheimer's, and I really loved them, and I tried to become family with them. And the pay was the thing that had to stop me, you know, from doing that because I had to choose between doing what I love and paying my bills. And I would just love to see these new healthcare workers at least get $15 an hour because it's a strain on you, especially when you're dealing with people with mental issues or their sicknesses. You have got to be so patient and so kind to them. In one case I had, I was so patient and kind to the man in the daughter that he was living with. She was very abusive to him. So you come into cases like that and you have to report them. It's a lot to do when you're a healthcare worker.
It does sound like it. Lucy, for you, I mean, you probably end up in the middle of all kinds of things.
Yes, and I mean, I have been involved in family arguments, families where they never went back to their loved one again because of disagreements. It is very touchy. It's very difficult at times. And being in healthcare, it's not an 8:30 to 5 job. It just continues, as our last caller said. It just continues.
And it affects people's jobs on the other, on all perspectives, right, Claire? Their professional lives and their personal lives.
That's right.
Our time is sadly up for today's conversation. Claire Stacey from the Sociology Department at Kent State University, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Lucy Stassi, a nurse with Kansas City Hospice, thank you for taking the time to share your insights. I really appreciate it.
And thank you.
We spoke earlier in today's show with economist Elise Gould, as well as care workers Kimmy DeVries and Lijua Manning. To listen back to any of this discussion, go to kcur.org/centralstandard later today. And you can listen to KCUR for further coverage of some of the issues we got into today. We're going to keep exploring this. Tomorrow, we'll be revisiting a food show about Latin American cuisine in Kansas City. Don't miss that. It's a fun one. And stay in touch with us on Twitter. You can keep this conversation about care, both affording care and needing care and providing it at, we're at KCUR CST. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross, and we could not have done today's show without contributor Andrea Tudhope. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.